gentlemen, please take your seats. The spotlight is about to begin. Good evening, everybody. I'm Mystery Matt, and you're listening to Episode 1, Season 9 of the Mystery Matt Spotlight Podcast. This evening, as we do with every season opener, we have a murder mystery crime, true crime thing for you. And obviously, with that, we have Sarah.
Hi.
And we are also joined by Nancy. Maybe Nancy can help us find the body spirit or the body or something with her magic powers and stuff.
Hi.
That's debatable today.
Yeah. She's already drained.
Well, this one's already solved, so.
Oh, it's already solved.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a different flavor.
Mmm, chocolate.
Yeah. Well, no, Irish cream.
Oh.
Oh, that sounded gross.
Anyways, I'll let you get into her. Oh, so I won't waste any more of your time.
All right. So this case came to me by a friend of mine who I used to work with, Kathleen. Shout out to Kathleen, who's from Ireland. So this case is an Irish case. This case was very challenging for me in terms of research because I only had one documentary to work with and one book. There was not a whole lot of information online. So the resources had been very limited, which is why I told Nancy, don't worry about research.
I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Yeah. So I did the best that I could do with what I had, and I hope, you know, I hope that the victims will feel important, even though it's not as much about them, unfortunately. But this is their story as well. So in order to do that, I have to talk about the monsters responsible. So this case has ups and downs of political and religious nature, and I wasn't sure if I could leave anything out, but I could not. So I couldn't get around it. I know Matt doesn't like either of those things on the Mystery Matt, but sometimes they come.
We just don't like taking sides.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one is kind of like you're taking sides. Well, but we probably wouldn't because none of us care that deeply about either side of that kind of thing. So to get to the understanding of the case, we have to kind of start a little bit further back. So in the 1960s, there was a lot of strife that divided the Catholic and Protestants in Northern Ireland. A deadly battle between the two religions who worshiped the same God. In the middle of it, political boundaries between paramilitary groups, the IRA, known as the Irish Republican Army, and the UVF and the UDA, also known as the Ulster Volunteer Force and the Ulster Defense Association. People were blowing up people, gunning them down, and slitting throats. Sorry, my throat. Speaking of throats, mine's a little sore today and a little hoarse. The conflict in Northern Ireland began in 1968 and lasted 30 years until 1998, where Protestant Unionists, known as Loyalists, wanted to stay a part of the United Kingdom. The Roman Catholics desired to become part of the Republic of Ireland. So you have two very strong-willed political sides, both backed by religion, and now you're sitting almost literally on a powder keg. The Irish Republican Army, or IRA, became the defenders of the Nationalists, while Ulster Defense Association, or UDA, and the UVF, which we'll just go by their initials from here on out, backed the Loyalists. Both sides would come to cause some mass casualties. On January 30th, 1972, saw the powder keg combust. This is the date that would become known as Bloody Sunday. Yeah, no singing. We get strikes for copyright.
You didn't pick me up on that, did you?
He's not even listening.
I'm working on.
So a rally of Catholic civil rights supporters were peacefully demonstrating in the Londonderry area when British paratroopers opened fire, killing 13 and injuring more. The IRA would retaliate, upping the violence level in attempts to push the British out. The worst of it taking place on July 21st, 1972, which I think became known as Bloody Friday, when the IRA set off 20 explosions around Belfast. What could possibly make these matters worse for civilians? How about a gang of Catholic-hating psychopathic serial killers? That's what. Is it a stroke of genius to hide these nefarious deeds under the guise of the Loyalist versus National dispute? Maybe, but doesn't make any of it right. So, just for a quick thing, so you... The Ulster Volunteer Force was formed by Lord Edward Carson. Sectarian means denoting or concerning a sect or sex, ethnic or and sectarian differences. And sex means sex or sex mean a group of people with somewhat different religious beliefs. Just in case you hear me say those words, now you know what they mean. So, to see where this starts, we unfortunately need to meet the mastermind and the leader of the Shankill Butchers, Lenny Murphy. Lenny Murphy was the youngest of the Murphy family, named Hugh Leonard Thompson Murphy, and was born March 2nd, 1952. He was a bully at school, and by the age of 10, he would often relieve his schoolmates of their pocket money while using a knife, and he was not the best student in school, as he didn't apply himself to his studies and was remembered as being devious, cunning, unstable, and his parents frequently moved around Northern Ireland during his youth, so he had a feeling of upheaval. He was street smart and used his older brothers as part of his threats and manipulations to his other schoolmates. Murphy was arrested at the age of 12 for breaking into a shop and was charged with larceny. He was given 2 years probation and was ordered to pay either eight shillings, which is 14 cents Canadian, so seemed hardly worth it, right? 14 cents Canadian. When I had to do the conversion of that, that was fun. It was not easy to do because shillings, it kept giving me like African shillings. So I had to like be very specific. So that might be a little off. So bear with me. In high school, Lenny had a small criminal enterprise going on. He was able to manipulate other students to threaten and steal their meal tickets, then turning around and selling them at a reduced rate. How this works is he's getting the meal tickets or vouchers off of students for nothing and then making money off them by selling them for cheaper price to other students than what they would originally purchase for. The criminal instinct was something that clearly came natural to Lenny Murphy. He was able to manipulate others very easily. Murphy found himself in trouble in 1968 when he was arrested for theft and received probation for 1 to 2 years. He joined the junior wing of the UVF, as it will be referred to, as I said earlier. In August 1969, Murphy was part of the violence that saw Protestants invade many of the Catholic streets all over Belfast, burning down hundreds of homes, causing thousands of Catholic families to leave the city for safety. In 1970, paramilitary UDA was formed. January 30th, 1972, as I said, was known as Bloody Sunday, and this was the first parachute regiment shot and killed 13 innocent civilians. And the UVF and UDA wanted to seek revenge on the IRA and other Catholics. Murphy took to making himself very familiar with the law by attending many murder trials of the UVF family as a spectator. He also attended trials of the IRA members in order to find out who was working in the IRA. And you can tell he's very intelligent. Cunning is very right word to describe this man. He had established his own small gang in 1970 and 71, which was referred to as the Murphy Gang. It is alleged that this gang was responsible for the death of Catholics. Murphy was working as a shop assistant and was seen as a very hardworking man, but there's no way this job was facilitating his lifestyle, which was clearly paid for by the criminal activities. So let me start with a little bit of the first crimes, which he is allegedly the mastermind of and involved in. And once we get to the next set of crimes, you kind of understand why. So on July 21st, 1972, Francis Arthurs was a 43-year-old Catholic man who frequented the local pubs. On this unfortunate night, he was walking home on Crumlin Road, which ran parallel to the Shankill Road in the Protestant area of the city of Belfast. He was ambushed and taken to the Lawnbrook Social Club, where he was tortured publicly in the UVF-dominated club, suffering severe beatings and then stabbed repeatedly in parts of his body, interrogated...
What's UVS?
UVF?
Yeah.
The Ulster Volunteer Force.
Oh.
Which I said at the beginning, but you were on your phone.
I was doing things for the page.
Oh, okay.
It was a sneak peek.
Oh. God. Anyways, he was... interrogated and tortured for hours until he was ultimately shot. His body was dumped miles away in the street. On August 13th, that same year, 48-year-old Thomas Madden was a bachelor who was polite and devout Catholic who frequented Mass. He was employed as a nighttime security guard. Shout out to the security guards. 3 days before his murder, he was taken to a club on Shankill, where he was interrogated for 24 hours.
Bad time to laugh.
I know, right? Bad time to shout out to security guards. He had his rosary, cigarettes, lighter, and money all taken away from him. He He was asked which pubs he frequented and if he knew of any IRA men in the area in which he lived. When he was released, he got all his possessions back with the exception of his money. On his way to work, a couple days later, he was picked up again around the Crumlin Road area and taken to a lockup garage, and for 6 hours he was tortured, being suspended from a wooden beam after being stripped of all his clothing. Long cuts made by a knife were made down his back and thighs, and he was stabbed 147 times. If that wasn't enough, his body was then dragged for 100 yards and thrown over a metal gate to a shop's doorway. His cause of death was listed as strangulation. September 22nd, 1972, 4 weeks after Madden's murder, William Matthews was found dead with knife wounds, which matched the same signs of torture and character of the wounds similar to the attacks on Madden's and Arthur's. His body was found in the Glen Cairn estate.
Wow. That's really somebody that enjoys torturing people.
Like, ew.
Like, that, but
that's
like,
a lot.
That is a lot.
That's usually like a crime of passion that usually hits that stab count, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, but it's a seems like it's a passion to kill and torture. Like, that is, that, wow.
There's a hint that's of sexual lot. Sadism right there. Like, it gets worse. Like, these are not even listed as Shankill Butcher victims. These are listed as people who are suspected of being Shankill Butcher victims. So wait till we get to the actual Shankill Butcher victims. So on...
he was born this way?
Yeah. Well, he was born to a Catholic hating family. Because they were all Protestants.
Let's not jump ahead. Let's keep it going.
No, I already talked a little bit about his family.
Oh, about who he was.
So basically, Lenny Murphy's family were Protestants in Northern Belfast or Northern Ireland, and it was divided between Catholic and Protestant.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. There's hate.
Sorry, there's hate. And then there's that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that, that's like the wall kind of hate. You, that movie, the Pink Floyd one?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
So on September 28th, 1972, Lenny Murphy and Mervyn John Connor, who was 20 years old at the time, were ordered by the UVF to carry out a hit on fellow Protestant William Pavis. The reason behind the hit was that Pavis went to prison for illegally possessing firearms and appearing in court with a Roman Catholic priest, Father Eamon Corrigan, who Pavis had sold the shotgun to illegally. When Pavis was released a year later, Lenny Murphy made sure he was all buddy-buddy with Pavis and made him comfortable. When Pavis wasn't paying attention, Murphy pulled out a gun and shot him at close range. There were witnesses to this shooting, which was sloppy by Murphy's standards, and he and Connor were arrested. If there was any signs of the level of Murphy's intelligence, it came through during the police lineup. Murphy began yelling and making a scene that he didn't want to be a part of the lineup, which was how he stood out. This was a strategy that would ultimately work in his favor and his defense. They could say because of the spectacle he made of himself, the witnesses picked him out of that because of it, and not based on what they actually saw, clouding the judgment and memory recall of the witnesses, which is very intelligent because memory recall for witnesses are often questioned to begin with. Police struggled to make their charges stick, and Connor wasn't stupid enough to just give Murphy up because he was afraid of what Murphy could do to him. In January 1973, Mervyn Connor was offered a deal if he implicated Lenny Murphy in the murder of Pavis. They kept up the pressure on Connor, and they did their best to safeguard any prison meetings by trying to keep those a secret. Not only were the loyalist paramilitary prisoners inside Crumlin Road, but there was also prison wardens who belonged to the UVF, and it didn't take long for the word to spread to the UVF, and within 24 hours of Connor's meeting, Murphy and other Crumlin Road prisoners knew about it. Connor agreed to turn on Murphy, and he was then deemed a high-risk prisoner, and guards were assigned to him 24/7 for safety and to be kept away from UDA and UVF members inside the prison, especially Murphy. Murphy was working in the prison hospital and had plans to kill Connors and didn't care who he took out in the process. In March, he poisoned a pot of custard with cyanide for Connor, but no one at the table where Connor was eating ate any of it, including Connors. He may have failed at the attempt, but he would find it funny later on. In April, Murphy was somehow given free rein of the prison. Luck would have it, the two guards who were assigned to protect Connor from Murphy and other UDA UVF members got wrapped up in watching television with some of the other prisoners while Connor's was in his cell. Murphy, with a pencil, piece of paper, and some cyanide, went to Connor's cell, grabbed him by the throat, and forced him to write on the paper. When Connor's was done, Murphy poured the vial of cyanide down Connor's throat. On the paper in Connor's handwriting was him saying he killed Pavis and that Murphy had nothing to do with it. Prison wardens and police knew that it was Murphy who killed Connor's and forced him to write such a confession. They wanted to know if anyone was working with Murphy, which allowed him the freedom to wander about. Major Mullen launched an investigation into whether prison staff assisted Lenny Murphy and interviewed the infirmary staff as well. Mullen wanted to know who gave Murphy the pass, and he was also investigated the guards who were responsible for guarding Connor. Major Mullen talked to Murphy, who told Mullen that he wasn't the only person who wanted Connor dead, and he wasn't the one who did it. Since then, the police report has gone missing. Murphy's actions placed him in the good books of the UVF by having one person take the fall without actually pointing the finger to them or to Murphy. But it also made it clear that Murphy was more than capable of reaching anyone out there willing to snitch on him, including in a high-max prison. Fear of Murphy was increasing, and despite the fact that he did the UVF a favor, they also knew they couldn't control him. So despite Connor's forced written confession, Murphy went to trial for the murder of Pavis on June 18, 1973. Murphy was able to claim that he never even met Pavis and that the eyewitnesses and their bias against him for picking him out of the police lineup was because he made a fiasco and lack of evidence as well. The jury decided to set Murphy free, but Murphy wouldn't make it very far as he was quickly rearrested and held under the Northern Ireland Special Powers Act, which is, quote, empowered certain authorities of the government of Northern Ireland to take steps for preserving the peace and maintaining order in Northern Ireland and for purpose connected there within, end quote. Under this act...
It's literally a law against shit disturbers.
Yeah, basically. Under this act, Murphy was instantly returned to the Crumlin Road prison. February 1974, Murphy was moved from the Crumlin Road prison to Loncash, which is now, I think, called Mays. And it's just located outside of Belfast. Loncash was operated more of a military-style prison where prisoners were taught to think in a less terrorist way of life and more positive and politically. Murphy denounced authority and the duties assigned to him. He would refuse to do them, such as cleaning bathrooms in the huts. He felt that type of work was beneath him. While at Loncash, Murphy's charisma and authoritative way had some admirers gravitating towards him. One, Robert Basher Bates, was one of them. Bates was serving time for firearms. But like Murphy, Bates had conflict with the UVF area in the Loncash prison. They severely beaten a UVF officer. UVF, that's really hard to say over and over again. Leader of Loncash section described Murphy as a back shooter. Yeah. In 1975, an anti-sectarian assassination conference was held where the loyalists suggest that to stop the killing of non-combatant Catholics, the IRA should cease the killing of off-duty police officers and soldiers who are members of the UDA. And UDA member Sam Smythe made the comment that as far as he was concerned, a 3-year-old child or a 70-year-old woman belonging to the Catholic community were just as much targets as anyone else. And they then was quickly reprimanded by the leader of the West Belfast UDA, leader Jim Craig. The agreement reached wouldn't make Lenny Murphy very happy, who began to make plans for when he would be released. 3 weeks later, Sam Smythe was assassinated, likely due to his comments at the conference and likely from under orders of the UDA to prevent further problems. See, it's all very... can you see how hard this one was to do? And I'm not even halfway through it yet. On May 13th, Lenny Murphy walks out of Loncash and returned to Northwest Belfast, where he decided to set up his own gang that was not under the control of the UVF. He established the Brown Bear Pub on Shankill Road as his headquarters. Sorry, my nose is completely stuffed. Dubbing them as the Brown Bear Unit, and was soon joined up by Robert Bates and needed about 15 others to round out his group. So he's bringing in his close friends, Mr. A and Mr. B, who have never been named and never been caught, as well as Sam McAllister, 26-year-old William Moore, who were dubbed as his lieutenants. At the time, Moore was also driving a black taxi that resembled those black taxis found in England, and Moore had previously worked as a meat packer who stole several knives and meat cleavers before leaving. The other recruits to Murphy's gang were 22-year-old Arthur Armstrong McClay, 24-year-old Benjamin Edwards, 23-year-old Norman Waugh, 21-year-old William Arlo Green, 19-year-old Thomas Noel Green, yes, they are brothers, 31-year-old Edward Leckie, 22-year-old David John Bell, 22-year-old Edwin McLuhan, and 14-year-old William John Townsley. The Brown Bear unit had a rival unit who were set up at the Windsor Pub. Anthony Berry was the leader of the Windsor unit. So the more people Murphy had surrounding him, the better, as it offered protection against him, Berry, and the UVF groups. Yeah, we're all suffering because we're doing this outside. This was a great idea. October 2nd, 1975, Murphy, Moore, and the two Green brothers set out to attack a target in the Millfield area, a Catholic-run business called Casey's Wholesale Wine and Spirits. Why are you laughing?
You said MILF.
Millfield.
Yeah, but when you stuttered, you said MILF.
Oh.
Yeah.
My God. You guys suck. Anyways, it was a Catholic-run business.
Catholic moms can be MILFs too, you know.
You shouldn't be racist.
I wasn't! Oh my God! Drink up.
You're welcome for your comic relief.
Yeah.
That's what we're here for.
I know. He told the appointed crew that this was a robbery and proceeded to hand out guns in case of trouble. Casey's was not only a Catholic family-owned business, but also employed four Catholics as well. That day, Francis Donnelly, Marie McGrattan, Gerard Grogan, and Thomas Osborne were working. When they entered the store early in the morning, Murphy and William Green drew their guns, forcing both Francis Donnelly and Marie McGrattan to the office, while Noel Green and William Moore held Grogan and Osborne in the storefront. The two women tried to tell Murphy and Green that there was no money on the premises so early in the morning, but Murphy kept searching the office while Green kept his weapon trained on the two women. When Murphy found nothing, he shot Marie McGrattan in the back of the head with his .45 Colt semi-auto, and William Green fired his .22 into the head of Francis Donnelly. Murphy and William Green joined Moore and his brother Noel Green and inquired about Gerald Grogan and Thomas Osborne about their religions. Once they said they were Catholic, Murphy shot them both. When he and his team fled the shop, Thomas Osborne was able to make it to the street and was taken to the hospital but would die a few weeks later. Marie McGrattan's husband arrived at the shop and discovered the bodies and called police. Noel and William Green were caught by police and questioned about the shop shooting, but neither would give up Moore or Murphy. William Green would crack under the pressure but still managed to keep their names out of it and lied about his own role in the murders. He said that when one woman was killed, he was startled and his own gun went off, killing the other, and that the whole thing kept him up at night because it sickened him. Bullshit.
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 We need a bullshit button where it goes bullshit.
Yeah, we need a bunch of buttons.
We need a bunch of buttons. Noel Green said that he didn't even know the name of the men who drove him to the shop because they were both afraid of Murphy.
I think I would be too from the sounds of this guy.
Yeah, he's a nutwinger, that's for sure. On October 2nd, 1975, there was another crime that was not connected to Murphy and his gang. On the same day as Casey's quadruple murder, a photographer was killed inside a studio, a woman was killed in a bomb attack on a Catholic-owned bar, and many others were injured in shootings and bombings. A total of 11 were dead. Four UVF men died near Coleraine when their own bomb detonated while they were transporting it. The UVF took responsibility for the day's actions, and then the following day found that they were banned from the Democratic Labor Party's Merlin Reese.
All we are saying
is give copyright a chance.
Holy crap.
Yeah. So, sadists need aggression in the conflict currently happening in Northern Ireland provided that. So, not only did it trigger the aggression, it gave them an excuse to be aggressive. It became their outlet. It became socially acceptable by expressing the prejudices against the other sect of Northern Ireland, meaning Catholic on Protestant crime and Protestant on Catholic crime. In late 1975, Murphy took it upon himself to go it alone from the new brigade staff of the UVF. You done? Okay. This gives him more freedom to operate under his own mindset while still enforcing his beliefs against the Catholic community, showing his very single-mindedness, his sense of omnipotence and invincibility. All Catholics were potential targets, men, women, and children. On November 24th, 1975, after reading an article that was published in a newspaper that dealt with the killings of soldiers in graphic detail and the overwhelming need for more tightened security and stricter protocols to deal with the IRA, prompted Murphy to call a meeting with the plan to hit another Catholic. Murphy and Moore with the other members of the Brown Bear unit, decided to tour Antrim Road. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing some of these roads right, just FYI. Anyways, they were finding that it was a suitable hunting ground for Catholics. Moore's black taxi could act as a cover in case they were stopped by police or military that may be out on the streets. Moore could easily claim that he was carrying passengers, so Murphy mapped out a 10-minute route. Francis Crossan was a 34-year-old Catholic who was leaving a club just around midnight. At around 12:30, he was spotted walking down Library Street by Murphy and his gang. Murphy, Edwards, and Waller rushed out of the taxi, with Murphy hitting Crossan over the head with a wheel brace, which we call a tire iron, then dragging him into the taxi where they continued to beat him. When at the desired destination, Crossan was dragged out of the taxi and into an alley where Murphy used a large butcher knife to hack Crossan's throat until his head was nearly severed. His body was found the next day by an elderly woman out looking for her cat. Poor old lady. Glass from the broken beer bottle was lodged in his forehead, and his cause of death was from the throat cutting. The pathologist also noted the root of his tongue was severed, and he had suffered multiple abrasions and bruises.
When is it too far?
What?
Like he just got his fucking head off.
Oh, he's not the only one.
The heck do you watch on TV? You're worried about...
I listen to this stuff and watch this stuff to go to sleep.
I don't, actually.
You're worried about me and my conspiracy theories. Like, I believe maybe 1 out of 100 of those things. But, like, ew.
Do you want me to come up with autopsy reports?
No.
So, note to self, don't fuck up, because you will disappear, and she has probably learned how to do that.
Can you clear my browser history?
They're never going to find my body, are they, Nancy?
If it happens, I will do a podcast on it by myself, and I will say, what do I ask you to say about me? Oh, she was fantastic until she just snapped one day.
Yeah. If I die, can you call Patty Mac for me? I got stuff to say. You know?
Oh, okay. The UVF units were told by UVF leaders that anyone who strayed from their rules would be dealt with. Although they preferred not to work with units like Murphy's, they knew that Murphy was the right person to do their cleanup. They brought Murphy in to find out who was responsible for threatening an elderly lady on Shankill Road for the whereabouts of a small amount of money. And he was to turn them over to the UDA, if they were UDA members, to be dealt with. Murphy was smart enough not to use his own team, so he recruited a few from the Windsor Bar Unit to help track down the ones responsible. So Roger McRae, Edward Bell, and Stuart E. Robinson were the likely suspects and were set to be kneecapped. That shot through the back of the knee to cause maximum damage. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh. Ew.
Yeah. Ouch, actually comes to mind.
Yeah.
I think I'd rather be killed at that point.
There's a lot of, like, it's not just putting a hit out and having somebody killed. It's, like, creative, intensive torture.
Yes.
Like, how could I, how much pain could I inflict before they die?
Yeah.
Is exactly what it is. And then I'm going to cut their tongue out and take it with me.
Yeah. Well, like, like things like a Colombian necktie.
What the fuck is that?
That's where they slit your throat and they pull your tongue out through the opening in your throat. Okay. And that's like, ew, because you got to sit there and do it. You got to.
But I think by the time you have your throat cut, you're not really going to feel the tongue being pulled down. But I mean, you'd feel being shot in the back of the kneecap.
Oh,
yeah.
And,
you know, like little slits here and there. And what was that one? 147
stab wounds.
Like, for crying out loud. Like,
yeah, one's like, enough.
That was before the...
And he wasn't so even, like he wasn't...
He wasn't a criminal.
But he wasn't abused or, like, things like that growing up. Like, the fuck, you're born that way?
It's called nature.
Jesus fucking Christ.
I prefer the nurture way. At least they're not as savage. These nature guys are fucked.
You call Edmund Kemper did not savage?
I don't know. Have we done that one already?
I covered it in the Nurture versus Nature podcast.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
You weren't probably listening.
I think this is
kind of over the top for most of them, I think, that you've done.
The torture aspect.
Yes.
The gore level.
So are we glad that Kathleen brought this to me?
Yeah.
You know?
Causing interesting conversations, which is what I've been wanting.
I do remember.
You got to bring the shock value. That's what South Park says.
Yeah, well, that's shock value, all right.
Well, my mom was Irish. Yeah. And she used to talk a lot about, because when we learned about the war in Ireland, my mom would talk about it and be like, yeah, you know, like it was bad.
Is she from Northern?
I don't know. Here. Have one of those.
Oh, thank you.
I'm not sure where, because it was my grandma that came over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even sure. She might have not even, I'm not even sure she was born here or not.
Oh.
Yeah, there was she's like, it was bad.
Like, I really should have had Kathleen come to this. Like, yeah, I was probably thinking about it.
Should have, would have, could have.
Like, doing it from the condo or something.
Was she living there at the time?
No, she was my office manager.
No, but, like, how did she?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember her saying that they were scared all the time because she's, I believe, Catholic, so they were scared all the time. Anyways, so I'm going to try to attempt a cigarette and read at the same time.
I'm Protestant, but I wouldn't do any of that shit.
I don't have anything against Protestants or Catholics, and I'm not.
I know a bunch of Catholics, and none of the Catholics I know would do any of that shit.
I would never.
No, and you're.
Yeah, Nancy's Catholic.
Yeah.
Hey, look, we got one.
Our friend John.
We need a Buddhist.
I'm the pagan. Does that work?
Vinny was on.
Yeah.
But he's Catholic.
I thought he was Hindu. Ooh.
No.
That's a really good podcast idea.
What?
What?
How many people of different religions can we put together and have a debate and a discussion?
Oh, I don't know.
But friendly.
Could we handle that?
Friendly debate.
Like, yeah, like respectful.
It never ends up in friendly debate. No, that's the problem.
It depends on who you get.
That's why we stay away from religion and politics unless we're like, you know, saying something cool like the Nephilim and stuff like that, the conspiracy parts.
Yeah, I can debate religion because, I mean, I'm not exactly following the Catholic religion anymore, but I follow aspects. So, I mean, like, I can sit and debate it in a logical form.
Like, you can get a priest and a rabbi together because they're almost playing the same game.
Rabbis are funny.
But you start bringing some of, like, the other religions that don't follow Christianity, then things start getting messy.
I might have more to say against the Catholics, though, with the whole child thing.
The residential schools?
Yeah,
I don't think any of them got it right.
Stuff like that. Like, I don't think I would be able to.
But I think all of them have parts that are right.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't think any one religion is correct, but I think all parts of religion have things in it that are correct.
I think there's a sense of morale. If that makes sense. Morale in every religion, but there's also a lot of deceptions, too.
And interpretations. And
that also comes with the abuse of power.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is clearly what's going on here.
Oh, just a smidgen.
Yeah. So Murphy ordered Bates, Moore, and McAllister to beat them. But when Robinson decided to try to make a run for it, he was shot in the back and died. The other two suspects were ordered not to say a thing or they would be killed. They then dumped Robinson's body in a nearby alley. Archie Waller was named the shooter of Stuart E. Robinson, and the UVF ordered his death. A three-man assassin team was sent out to kill Waller, who was found sitting in his car behind the wheel next to Sam McAllister, who bolted when he spotted the crew coming up on Waller. Waller just sat there. Whatever, I guess. He didn't care. And he was shot point blank and died instantly. McAllister named Waller's killers as Noel Shaw, Desi Balmer, and Roy Stewart. Shaw was found at the Windsor Bar and brought to the Lawnbrook Club, where he was beaten and tortured by Murphy and Mr. A on stage in front of everyone in retaliation for Waller's death. Clearly, this was sending a message that you don't mess with Murphy and his team. Shaw was then interrogated, and then Murphy shot him through the wrist and then four more in quick succession into his head. Murphy ordered Bates and McAllister to find Stewart and Balmer and shoot them where they were found. Neither of the two were shot and killed, but Balmer was found. He was shot, but he survived, and Roy Stewart was never found and never really pursued. On January 10th, 1976, Deirdre and Ted McQuaid were walking home from a party when Deirdre was spotted by Murphy and his gang. Her husband, Ted, was peeing in some bushes and was not seen. The taxi stopped in I know, right?
Convenient. Weeks.
I don't know, I was peeing in the bushes.
Taxi stopped in front of Deirdre and Murphy got out pretending he was drunk when Ted McQuaid got in between the taxi and his wife. A gun was then pulled and pointed at Ted and two shots were fired. First went into his chin and the second into his chest and he died. Deirdre went unharmed. Which I'm actually surprised because at that point you want to get rid of the witness. February 7th, 1976... 55-year-old Joseph Quinn was walking home from a pub when Murphy hit him over the head with the wheel brace. and dragged to the floor of Moore's taxi and beaten severely on the way to Lawnbrook Social Club to pick up Benny Pretty Boy Edwards. Murphy took a butcher's knife and drew it across Quinn's neck, making a 3-inch incision. Just some of the knife marks found on him. Once in the Glencairn Estates, they carried Quinn to a grassy area, placing him on his back, where Murphy hacked away at his throat, with the fatal cut going all the way back to his spine. When Quinn's body was found, the police knew from the multiple footprints that the murder that he was murdered by more than one person. On February 9th, 1976, Murphy had plans to take out multiple Catholics in one incident. It was his big goal. So when he received a tip about a lorry, or a truck as we North Americans call them, carrying Catholics to a timber yard each morning that took route through the Shankill Road, Murphy made plans to hit it. Moore, Bates, Mr. A, and Murphy picked up a Thompson submachine gun and an MKL carbine, which was an American World War II rifle. And then they hijacked a Ford Cortina to begin their plan. The truck was parked outside of Adair's, where the driver, Henry McClelland, went to buy a newspaper. On the truck were six others. Harry McClelland, which was Henry's son, Mary Johnston, Raymond Carlisle, Archie Hanna, Louis McGee, and James Wiley. Hang on one second. Archie Hanna had also gone into the store to purchase a sandwich. As Henry McClelland exited the shop, he spotted the gunman approaching his truck and began yelling to the gunman, "Prods! They're all prods!" Meaning they were all Protestants. But his warning didn't work. Murphy and Bates opened fire. Archie Hanna and Raymond Carlisle were killed, and Louis McGee and James Wiley were injured. When the news broke later that the dead and injured were Protestants, Murphy went crazy, vowing to shoot twice as many Catholics. Either he did not hear the warning from McClelland, or he ignored it on purpose. Was this a mistake, or did he just not give two shits who he was killing, and the reaction was just an act? The UVF were convinced that this was the work of Provisional IRA, and he didn't correct them and said he wanted revenge.
I think he just likes killing people.
I agree 100% with that. On February 26th, 24-year-old Francis Dominic Rice was out playing snooker with friends, not drinking heavily enough to be drunk. He left with his friend Margaret to walk her to the taxi depot. Once she was there, he turned up Donegal Street. When Murphy leaped out of the Moore's taxi, I was going to say Maxie's, with a wheel brace, hitting Rice as he turned to run. Bates helped Murphy get Rice into the vehicle, and then they continued to assault him, punching and kicking him, also taunting him with a knife throughout the ride. They even cut him with a knife to torture him, just like the other victims. He was then carried into an alley and continued to be beaten before being hacked by Murphy, taking several minutes to cut through his throat until the blade touched the spine. Inspector Jimmy Nesbitt connected Rice's murder to Crossan and Quinn's murder based on the similarities. There was a possibility of a taxi being used in Rice's murder based on possible eyewitnesses seeing black taxis in the area, which was also seen in the vicinity of Crossan and Quinn's as well. Nesbitt ordered his team to get the name of any taxi drivers who were under suspicion and bring them in. This plan was very flawed, as it would not take very long for the word to get out to other taxi drivers. William Moore's taxi was on the list, but when the police inspected his taxi, they found nothing. Shortly after, Murphy ordered Moore to get rid of his taxi ASAP, and he took it to a scrapyard where it was destroyed. Moore traded in his taxi for a beige Mark II Cortina. Nesbitt wasn't done with his investigation. He wasn't planning on stopping. Problem was, he was not aware of the McQuaid murder, the Spirit Shop murders, which took place in a different jurisdictions, and guns were used, not knives. Clearly, their suspects preferred knives. Nesbitt created Operation Knife Edge, an undercover operation that plainclothes officers acting intoxicated were placed on the streets with hidden wires on them, and a team nearby listening and watching them. But the entire operation was not successful and was quickly abandoned. Could it have been that maybe some of his team were connected to the UDA or UVF, and Murphy caught wind of it? Using knives in politically motivated conflict was actually unusual and very unprecedented in the history of the Ulster terrorism, or in many non-Ulster politically motivated crimes around the world. Use of a knife is usually considered very personal, something used in an up-close crime, often seen in sexually motivated crimes. I'm not saying that it isn't used, it's just very rare. There is sufficient evidence to suggest that use of knives have been used by fringe paramilitary groups. Not to mention politically motivated murders usually took place during the day, whereas the butchers operated at night under the cloak of darkness. On March 2nd, 1976, things were becoming increasingly difficult for Murphy and his gang as mobile military patrols and police were now out cruising the streets. And on this particular night, Murphy had a few run-ins as he walked from pub to pub, just and after around after 1:20 a.m. Murphy met up with some of his crew, left the pub, and decided to cause some trouble. At 2:50 a.m., 25-year-old Mary Murray and 28-year-old Margaret McCartney were both Catholic and driving Mary's car through the same area where a lot of the murders had been taking place. But neither felt unsafe as they were safely in their own car. A car behind them flashed their headlights at them, which was common practice by police and military units, so Mary stopped and pulled over. The other car, a bronze Cortina, pulled up next to them and fired shots at them. Mary was hit once in the shoulder and twice in the chest, and Margaret managed to duck to it and avoid being hit altogether. The Cortina drove off. Military mobile unit patrol gunner Michael Mollison heard the shots fired and quickly mobilized his team to head towards Ballycillan Ballyclub. Ballycillan area in anticipation of the gunmen making their way to the Glencairn Estates.
Belician?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, Belician.
Maybe.
Belician.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways.
I think it's just the pronunciation, like the, where you're putting the
emphasis. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's a long I or.
Yeah.
Anyways, they had their vehicles pulled across the road to block, but the Cortina just sailed past them partially on the road and partially not. The patrol fired at the car hitting the car, but not the occupants inside. The gang dumped the car and took off, with Murphy tossing the gun into a tall hedge behind a cement wall. A car was hijacked, and at 4:05 a.m., Corporal Frank Harnett pulled over a red Fiat, with Murphy, Bates, and two others inside. They let the others go, but kept Murphy and handed him over to police. While waiting to be questioned, another officer allowed Lenny Murphy to use the washroom without supervision, and Murphy took the time to wash his hands and the sleeve of his jacket to remove any GSR, or gunshot residue. With Murphy in custody, the authorities went out to canvass the area for anything they could use against him and actually located the gun that Murphy ditched in the hedge. After this decision was made to leave the gun there and see if Murphy would return to retrieve it in hopes of capturing him. After hours of questioning and not getting anything from him, they released him in hopes that he might go get the gun. And a surveillance team was set up to watch the hedge and surrounding area. The next day, on March 3rd, Murphy showed up in a truck, was taken into custody again at the scene where he ditched the gun. During questioning, he claimed he never went near the hedge and didn't know anything about a gun. He was charged with two attempted murder charges of Mary Murray and Margaret McCartney and possessing firearm with the intent to endanger life.
I guess.
He pleaded not guilty to all charges. Of course. Because why would you say, oops, oh, my bad, I did. Anyways, with Lenny Murphy behind bars, law enforcement believed that they had the butcher in custody. And they did. But Murphy wasn't going down for it. Matters and decisions would be made in the name of Murphy while he was behind bars. On June 5th, 1976, four gunmen entered the Chlorine Bar and began shooting. They were wearing what was described by surviving witnesses as linen bags over their heads with eye and nose holes cut into it. Inside the bar were 11 patrons and the bar owner, who was also the bartender. Roland Cargill, Robert Emerson, John Emerson, Daniel McNeil, Frederick Graham, Patricia Mahood, known as Pat, William Greer, Francis Carruthers, Samuel Corr, John Martin, the bar owner and bartender, who was Catholic, Jimmy Coyle, and his friend Edward Farrell, who was also Catholic. When William Greer was exiting the washroom, he saw the gunman and ran back in, using his feet to hold the door shut. Greer was shot through the door, with bullets hitting him on both sides of his neck and once in his right leg. He was lucky enough to survive. Yeah. That was pretty smart, though, to hide behind the door. William Farrell and Jimmy Cole was shot twice in the back and died. And the bartender, who was also Catholic, Jimmy Coyle, was shot in the heart point blank and died instantly.
Oh, God.
Daniel McNeil, Samuel Corr, John Martin died, and three others were injured. With the exception of Farrell and Coyle, they were Protestants. The attack on the Chlorine Bar was a joint operation set up by the UVF using the Brown Bear and Windsor Bar teams. On August 1st, 1976, William Moore and Sam McAllister decided to work independently of the Brown Bear, this time to end go rogue. The two set out on Cliftonville Road, where they came across 49-year-old Cornelius Neeson, who was leaving the bingo hall where he worked as a bingo caller. McAllister got out of the vehicle and struck Neeson over the head with a hatchet. Moore joined in as they continued to beat him. They thought they may have seen a passing motorist and left, leaving Neeson behind. He was taken to the hospital, but he died a few hours later. Meanwhile, a plea deal was reached between the Crown and the defense. Murphy's lawyers knew that the evidence they had linking Murphy to the attempted murders of Murray and McCartney were circumstantial. So they offered the Crown prosecution that if they were to drop the two charges of attempted murder, then Murphy would plead guilty to the firearms charge. The Crown accepted, and Murphy would be sentenced to 12 years in prison. Only he would only serve 6 due to the 50% remission rule, which basically was introduced solely in Northern Ireland in the mid-70s. With the phasing out of special category status, which was provision for prisoners who claimed paramilitary allegiances. Moore was requested by Murphy to run the Brown Bear unit in his absence, with Mr. A acting as the go-between and available support to Moore supplying weapons, as well as instructions. On October 29, 1976, 21-year-old Stephen McCann and his 17-year-old girlfriend Frances Tohill were out for the night enjoying each other's company. The two met with Stephen's younger sister and her boyfriend at the Queen's Student Union bar around 7 p.m. While there, Stephen and Frances were invited to a party, but Frances was not sure if she was going to go with Stephen because she had a curfew at midnight, and he planned on staying at the house where the party was at overnight. But she decided to join him for a little while and went with him. They left the party at around 2 a.m., walking home towards Millfield Street or area. Yes, I said Milf again. William Moore and Sam... William Moore, Sam McAllister, William Townsley, and Artie McClay jumped them. One knocked down Frances and restrained her, while the other two knocked Stephen out and pulled him into the vehicle where they got Stephen onto the floor. They beat him and asked him his religion. They stopped at Mr. A's house, where Moore retrieved a butcher knife and a .22 caliber gun. Mr. A gave specific instructions to make sure he cuts the throat. Moore and the gang head to the Glencairn area at a community center, dragging McCann out of the car before shooting him in the head and then using the knife to cut Stephen's throat. When the police arrived on the scene, it was evident that the body had been staged. Stephen McCann was found on his back with his legs bent underneath him, head back and hands upwards on his chest. Nesbitt and his team are now second-guessing whether Murphy was indeed the butcher. On December 20th, 1976, Sam McAllister was a hothead, not so different than Murphy, and on this particular night, he found himself involved in an altercation with another UDA member, Thomas Easton. Sam was short and stocky type fella, but tough as balls, and Easton was making fun of him and his size. At around 1 a.m. when Easton left the club, he was confronted by a very pissed off McAllister, who knocked him out. McAllister proceeded to beat him and then drag his body into a churchyard. UDA members at the club earlier who witnessed this first confrontation took it to their leaders, who demanded that the UVF punish McAllister. The UVF decided to punish him by kneecapping him. He asked if his punishment could wait until after his wife had their child. 2 months later, McAllister received his punishment, but instead of being kneecapped, he was shot in the arm so he could still perform his domestic duties as a father. The arms healed quicker, and the damage was a lot less maximum. Okay. On January 29th, 1977, 30-year-old James Curtis Banks Moorhead, that's a mouthful, left the Rumford Street Social Club on Shankill Road and was leading staff officer, and he was a leading staff officer to the UDA. 2 days later, his body was found by a lorry driver. It looked as if Moore's body had been dragged approximately 12 feet, and fragments of his skull were found close to his body. He was also missing middle of his forefinger. Multiple abrasions and injuries to his head and face indicated that he'd been tortured. His body was dumped in a different district. The authorities in the district believe that this was the work of the Provisional IRA, but it was actually done by Robert Bates, McAllister, and Moore. February 2nd, 1977, Joseph Morrissey was a 52-year-old Catholic who was leaving the National Club after a few drinks. On his way home, he was attacked by McAllister, Moore, and McClay, and hit several times with a hatchet, dragged into the car where he was tortured, the torture continued with a knife. Once they reached Glencairn Estates, Morrissey was dragged from the car and Moore cut his throat and attempted to sever his head. So despite being behind bars, Lenny Murphy had all the power over his Brown Bear unit. He loved still calling the shots from behind the bars and the influence he had over the group. But what made it better was that he knew he was undermining the police's belief that he was the cutthroat murderer. With the murders continuing, Nesbitt and Fitzsimmons were questioning his involvement as well. Lenny Murphy is clearly a power-driven murderer, getting off on the murder or the power and control he exerts over people, whether it's having them do his dirty work, fearing him, or wielding the knife himself. On March 29th, 1977, Mr. A gave William Moore the same gun Lenny Murphy used to kill Ted McQuaid to use in another murder. No doubt this order came from Murphy himself. 24-year-old Davy Bell accompanied William Moore along with 25-year-old Norman Waugh And that guy only referred to as Winky.
Nice.
I knew I had to pause for that one. The group came across 43-year-old Catholic Francis Cassidy. He was approached by Watt and Bell, who laid a beating on him before getting him into the car. His throat was slashed, and he was shot with the gun provided by Mr. A. Things are about to get messier, believe it or not.
Ew, how?
Yeah. This is kind of where their fuck-ups are starting to happen, though, too. So, we jump to April 1977, where the UVF had only one bomb maker, James Tonto Watt. He was not nearly as efficient as an IRA bomb makers or bombers. Lenny Murphy never requested any of Watts' services due to the fact that he would have to obtain permission from the West Belfast UVF leadership, which would mean that he'd have to give up his independence and let them in on whatever plan he had. But Mr. A decided that he wanted to execute one of Murphy's plans to take out a group of Catholics and devised a plan to bomb Republicans in the heart of the Falls area. He was sure that the UVF leadership would approve of his plan, and he planned to use the fact that Republicans hold a large demonstration on Easter Sunday, which would fall on April 10th, and that would be the best time to strike the IRA. On April 4th, Mr. A obtained permission from the UVF and the assistance of James Tonto Watt. In order to execute his plan, he brought in Mr. B, Benny Pretty Boy Edwards, Norman Watt, and two others, purposely leaving Moore out, as he was the main one working on Murphy's orders. Watt sent some of the team members out to stake out a good location to load the bomb off, but they were unable to find a suitable place, so Watt went back out with them. Beer kegs were set out to block side streets, leading to predominantly Protestant areas to keep the Catholics out. Watt figured this was perfect and planned to set the bomb inside a beer keg in order for it to be blended with the others. On April 10th, 1977, Easter Sunday, the bomb Watt made was carefully transported in a beer keg earlier in the morning with two car teams, and was set to go off at 2 p.m. during the official Republican movement. Instead, it went off during the provisional march, killing a 10-year-old boy, Kevin McMenamin, and injuring many others. On April 20th, 1977, Watt provided another bomb for the UVF, where they planted it at a funeral, which killed two civilians.
That's insult to injury, right?
Yeah,
there.
Right. No shit, eh? In May, Jimmy Nesbitt felt like he was getting closer to capturing the Butcher. On May 2nd, another bomb made by Watt killed Corporal John Geddes of the Ulster Defense Regiment. Watts was eventually caught and given 9 life sentences.
Only 9?
9. On May 11th, 20-year-old Gerard McLaverty was attacked off Emerson. He wasn't killed but left unconscious, and he was taken to the hospital where he was in critical for a while, but he eventually recovered. The police stood by so that he was protected around the clock. At first, Nesbitt didn't think McLaverty's attack was connected to the Butchers, as they never left anyone alive. There were knife wounds found on each of his wrists, and he told police he was taken at gunpoint on Cliftonville Road. On May 18th, 1977, Nesbitt took advantage of the general strike, knowing that the streets would be filled with UVF and UDA members. He instructed two constables to disguise McLaverty and drive him around to see if he can spot any of his attackers. Shank Hill Road was indeed filled with members from the UVF and UDA, and McLaverty was able to identify two of his attackers, Sam McAllister and Benny Pretty Boy Edwards. Nesbitt issued a warrant for their arrest, and he included William Moore, based on the fact that Moore owned a yellow Cortina, and eyewitnesses said they had seen a yellow Cortina during some of the abductions. Moore was arrested under Section 12 of the Prevention of Terrorist Act 1976. The book was thick. Yeah, the book was thick. Yeah. So try sorting it afterwards. During the arrest, McAllister, who was in bed with his wife at the time, the police had come in, and they found a butcher knife sticking out of the floorboard beside his bed and another one under the bed. He claimed they were there for protection in case the IRA stormed his house. More knives were collected from his kitchen, and Morris Cortina was found at an associate's house and was brought in for testing, along with the knives from McAllister's for blood. Blood evidence on the rubber mat lining and on the rubber seal of the trunk. There was widespread blood evidence on the rubber mat taken from the trunk. Blood from the seal and the mat were consistent with sheep's blood, but no one offered why there was sheep's blood in the trunk. And fibers from the car matched those taken from McLaverty's clothing, but no evidence was found on any of the knives found in McAllister's home. On May 23rd, Bates and Townsley were arrested. Nesbitt assumed that Townsley would be easy to break since he was a juvenile, But he actually was tougher nut to crack than what he anticipated. On the 25th, McClay, Bates, Bell, and Waugh were all in custody. On the 13th of June, McLuhan and Edwards were arrested after going on the run. William Moore ended up spilling a lot of the tea, except he didn't take any direct responsibility for the cutthroat murders, nor did he name Lenny Murphy as the mastermind or having any part of the murders. During this, Bates also talked, doing a lot of the same thing as Moore. He wouldn't take any direct responsibility, and he would not name names. McAllister blamed all of his involvement on alcohol. Nesbitt was hoping to get someone he arrested to give up Lenny and detail his involvement, and he worked hard with Moore and Bates to do just that, even going as far as keeping a small contingent of people in the jail as to protect them and keep them safe as potential witnesses. The plan didn't ultimately work, but both Bates and Moore talked. They were still very much afraid of Murphy and the reach he had. Not only did they give up Murphy, but they gave up Mr. A and Mr. B as well. But by the time the director of public prosecutions actually got to the statement 18 months later, both Bates and Moore had recanted, making them unusable. June 18th, Moore, Townsley, and 21-year-old James Pott, as well as Lenny Murphy's 27-year-old brother, John Alexander Murphy, were arrested and charged with assault on Harold Underwood, which happened the day after the Easter bombings. June 22nd, 1977, Lenny Murphy was brought from his prison cell to talk about the murders, but Murphy wouldn't talk and said he just chuckled and said they had nothing that connected him to the murders, which they didn't. But Nesbitt was planning on telling Murphy that they had evidence directly connecting him to the cutthroat killings and Shaw, as well as the Lorry killings of the two men, but Murphy's response was just to laugh. It turned out to be a giant waste of time. On January 25th, 1979, the butchers who had been arrested entered their pleas of not guilty. But after lunch and after their counsel gave them advice, some of them changed their plea to guilty. McClay and Townsley decided to maintain their not guilty pleas. McClay said that his statement was made under duress, whereas Townsley attempted to plea down his charges to a lesser one. Both were denied by the judge. On February 18th, 11 accused butchers appeared in court and were charged with 19 murders. Moore, McAllister, Bates, Edwards, Townsley, Bell, McClay, Waugh, Leckie, Watt, and McLuhan. The judge began to send... The judge began to hand down their sentences on February 20th. Bates pleaded guilty to 10 murders and Moore pleaded guilty to 11. Together, their sentences equaled up to 2,000 years to run concurrent. McAllister, McClay, and Edwards were sentenced to 20 years to life. Waugh received 2 life sentences and to serve no less than 18. Watt was given another life sentence to run concurrently with the other 8 life sentences he was already serving. Bell was given 1 life sentence. Townsley, because he was a minor, was ordered to be detained at the pleasure of the Secretary of State of Northern Ireland. I have no idea what that means. I'm guessing under like a juvenile kind of thing. Leckie and McLuhan were each given 10 years. The judge handed down 42 life sentences in one sitting, which was the largest handed down in a single court in the British legal history. If you think that's where the stories end, you would be very mistaken. July 16th, 1982, just 3 years after the Brown Bear Unit was convicted, Lenny Murphy was released. His life was going to be different on the outside as his wife and daughter had moved on. Oh yeah, he had a wife and daughter. I skipped that part. He didn't seem to care all that much about it, which is actually very common among sociopaths. They only care for themselves. He was more focused on himself and regaining his power and control on Shank Hill Road, and he was already seeing a younger woman named Hillary. Not even a day after his release, Murphy, Mr. A, and Mr. B were at the Rumford Street Loyalist Club when a 33-year-old named Alexander Maxwell irritated Murphy. Maxwell was a Protestant, but it didn't seem to matter to Murphy. He suggested to Maxwell that they take a walk to the yard, where Murphy then proceeded to kick and beat him, leaving him there and leaving to retrieve his car and then proceeded to run him over. See, you can't change your stripes. It took 6 weeks after his release to rebuild a new unit, and he was able to obtain a car from a fellow named Brian Smythe with the promise that he would pay off the car soon. He was back to being a hotshot. Murphy, of course, relented on his debt to Smythe, but Smythe wasn't going away. The two men agreed to meet at the Rumford Club, which Smythe was smart enough to bring 2 of his guys with him for backup. Smythe and Murphy, of course, got into an argument, which eventually ended up Murphy agreeing that he would pay off the car in a few days. To seal the deal, Murphy bought Smythe a drink, and within minutes, Smythe wasn't feeling well. He and his buddies left to go to the bathroom, and when they returned, Murphy had slipped out. He was convinced that Murphy had poisoned him, and his buddies were accompanying him to the hospital. But during the trip there, a motorcycle was noticed following them, and they stopped the car. 8 shots were fired directly into Smythe, killing him instantly. We're almost there, people. We're in the home stretch. The UVF suspected that Murphy was behind it, and they weren't keen on having him back in the fray and being on the loose again. The UVF and the UDA felt that Murphy brought way too much unwanted attention to them from the RUC, which is the Royal Ulster Constabulary. On October 22, 1982, Murphy, along with members of his new gang, William Mahood, Noel Large, William Wingnut Cowan, and another man, were discussing a Protestant British Army officer's abduction, Tommy Cochran, by the IRA. Murphy felt that they should abduct a Catholic, but when he brought it up to one of the UVF leaders, they said no. Murphy was pissed, and when he left the club, he mentioned it again to another UVF member, but again, he was told no. So he and Cowan waved down a black taxi and ordered the driver to wait until the next day to report it. Joseph Donegan, a 48-year-old Catholic, waved down a taxi after leaving a pub, but he was not intoxicated. Unfortunately, it was the taxi that Murphy and Cowan had just hijacked. Donegan put up one hell of a fight, which just infuriated Murphy all the more, and he began beating him and forced him into the taxi. They took him to Murphy's former home, which was now vacant, but also across the street from his current home. This was a stupid mistake, and all criminals eventually do something this stupid. Murphy would torture Donegan, and even pulling out all but 3 of his teeth with pliers. Murphy, yeah, I know, that's probably the one that got me. I was like, ugh. Anyways, Murphy had zero intention of ever letting Donegan leave alive, but was still planning on using his abduction as leverage to try to get Cochran back from the IRA. The plan worked to a degree, as the abduction of Donegan was used by the Loyalists to bargain for Cochran, but the IRA said that Cochran was a serving British Army officer and Donegan was not. Donegan's body was supposed to be moved in the middle of the night, but a couple of Murphy's team struggled to get him into the trunk of a car and was seen by a witness, so they dropped him in the alley behind Murphy's former home. When the police and news reporters were there, they found that inside the vacant home, it was just covered in blood, and they found some teeth. Police spotted Murphy amongst the spectators and arrested him. Problems rose quickly as the residents where the murder took place used to belong to Murphy, and so it made sense that his fingerprints would be found in the house, which would make the defense easy, like give the defense an easy explanation as to why they were there. Police could not prove that Murphy killed Donegan and had to release him. Murphy had created a mess for the UVF, and they were not happy. And in the end, the IRA still killed Tommy Cochran, and his body was found beaten and shot at the border. After Murphy was released from his recent arrest, Murphy was receiving death threats. His behavior reflected a sense of paranoia as he was becoming less predictable and more erratic. The only thing that was constant was that he would stay at his girlfriend's home in the Glencairn Estates. He would always park his car in the back alley and using her back entrance. I knew somebody was going to laugh. I knew it. He was also fully aware that the UVF no longer supported him, and the UDA felt the same way, viewing him as a psychopath. Don't tickle the hole.
Maybe it's like a bad idea that I sit across from you. the minute
you say something, the two of us are like, oh.
I know, because I'm so engrossed in reading, I can't see what y'all are doing, right? On November 16th, 1982, at 6:40 p.m., Murphy made his way over to his girlfriend's house in the Glencairn Estates. For someone who was extra paranoid about people around him, he was totally unaware that he had been followed by a blue van. When he parked his vehicle and turned off the ignition, the van pulled in front of him, and the back doors opened. 2 armed gunmen stepped out, one with a 9mm submachine gun and the other with a 38 special, and opened fire, killing Lenny Murphy. The Provisional IRA staked their claim the following day via the media, giving details of the type of weapon they used, but there was some conspiracy in regards to this claim. With the Provisional IRA and the UDA-UVF being bitter enemies, and Murphy being murdered in a Protestant-dominated area, would have made it extremely difficult for the IRA to do their recognizance work before executing the hit. There was no doubt that the Provisional IRA had hit teams already ready to go at different parts of the Catholic sector of Belfast, who were just waiting to be told when to go if Murphy was nearby. Both the Provisional IRA and the Loyalist UDA-UVF were in agreement about one thing. Lenny Murphy had to go. So what happened? Did they work together to get the job done in secret? No doubt that if many in the UVF knew about this plan to get rid of Murphy, news would have trickled down to him, and we all know that he would have struck first and not bothered to ask questions later. He would have just taken anyone out he thought was after him. I find it strange that with all his paranoia and him knowing that he was not in good books with either, that he didn't already strike first. 6 months after his death, Noel Large told the police that he didn't know who killed Murphy, but that he suspected his own side was behind it, and that he was afraid that if he said too much, he would suffer the same fate as Murphy. Here's something we can discuss a little bit. Lenny's mother, Joyce Murphy, was quoted in the paper saying, "My Lenny would not have hurt a fly." Yeah.
Okay, now I see where the delusion comes from.
Right? Oh, it gets worse. Well, we're done with most of the deaths of the actual victims, but this kind of adds insult to the injury to the wounds. Yeah, I can't speak. Lenny Murphy received a hero's funeral, with the epitaph on his headstone reading, "Here lies a soldier." Some regarded him Some regarded him as just that, a hero, but most saw him as more of a monster. A monster who used the strife between the Catholic and Protestants as an excuse to murder innocent people. He wasn't concerned whether or not they were part of the IRA. He asked, I think, to make his gang believe in the cause, when there were really no causes. Victims like... I was going to name them all. I will. Marie McGrattan, Francis Donnelly, Jared Grogan, Thomas Osborne, Francis Crossan, Noel Shaw, Ted McQuaid, Thomas Quinn, Archie Hanna, Raymond Carlyle, Francis Rice, Cornelius Neeson, Stephen McCann, Thomas Easton, James Moorhead, Joseph Morrissey, Francis Cassidy, Kevin McManaman, Jared McLeverty, who luckily survived, Norman Maxwell, James Galloway, Brian Smythe, and Joseph Donegan. Many of the members of the Brown Bear Squad have been since released from prison or have died. Joseph Morrissey's daughter said in the documentary that I watched on YouTube that during the funeral of Robert Bates, who was responsible for killing her father in 1997, more than 1,000 people lined the streets to celebrate him as a hero, and that she actually got stuck in traffic for 2.5 hours and had to sit through all of that. Can you imagine being stuck in traffic as the funeral for the monster who killed your father or a loved one was just being celebrated? Like, that, she had to be physically ill. I felt so bad for that. When I heard that, I was like, ugh. Like, I felt for her. William Moore died in 2009, and on his headstone, it read the same as Murphy: "Here lies a soldier." All of the convicted Shankill butchers are free from jail now, with 9 still alive and living in Northern Ireland. Justice was not served here, and I may not know a whole lot about Ireland's justice system or the religious or political divide, but to me, that's a lot of violent people out on the streets. Don't get me wrong, a lot of them have to be old now, maybe unable to operate, but that is still not justice for the victims or their families. Sectarianism is still very much part of the communities today in Northern Ireland. Quote, "To understand sectarianism in Northern Ireland is to view the key issues that drive division and antagonism. To return to the beginning, the main cleavage in Northern Ireland is mutually exclusive forms of national self-determination. This dynamic fueled the conflict known as the Troubles, resulting in 3,500 deaths and in the region of 100,000 serious injuries. Political and social divisions, unsurprisingly, were intensified in this period, particularly in relation to political polarization and residential segregation." And that was from an article by Professor John Nagle. Because of the Shankill butchers, 19 people died. 9 of them were Protestants. So they didn't seem to care who they hurt or the destruction they inevitably left. In recent, a mural honoring the UVF was placed on Glenwood Avenue, just off the Shankill Road area. It was infuriated many as it honored the Shankill butchers among a list of the dead UVF men. It included Lenny Murphy and his brother, and Robert Basher Bates and John Townsley, all convicted murderers. The butchers used issues in their community to simply kill. They were serial killers, not heroes. It was fueled by hatred based on religion. Or was it simply disguised as the reason for killing innocent people? The end.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's the grossest one yet.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It was definitely not an easy one to get through. I did struggle getting through that. Excuse me. What I found the most disturbing is using the conflict and using the religion as an argument as to making killing somebody okay. And you guys know I'm not the most religious person. I'm far from it. I don't think any excuse, whether it be religion or color or whatever, sexuality, as an excuse to kill somebody.
No, I think...
I think that was just they took it and ran with it.
I think so, too. I don't think there's any rhyme or reason.
That amount of torture?
Mm-mm. It's almost like they had their own private purge.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I couldn't think of the word I wanted the other day. But purge fits. Like,
that's essentially what they were doing. They were trying to get rid of the other religion entirely in their area. And
one was trying to outdo the other, and back and forth it went, right?
Well, just like any gang, any charged entity that resorts to violence.
Like Bloods versus Crips. It's trying to oust the other one.
Yeah, you know, power, yeah. East Coast versus West Coast, all that kind of stuff, right? You know, we did that Biggie special.
Yeah, the Tupac and Biggie. Yeah, that one was interesting, too, you know, when you think about it.
Yeah, so there is, like, gang stuff related into that for sure.
I had known about Bloody Sunday, but I never actually knew what it was until I hit this case. Because it wasn't like it was taught here. It wasn't. It was not really covered. It was only alluded to because of the U2 song. And I'm not a big fan of U2.
Yeah.
But you knew the song.
It's right? Funny. Yeah, just a dumb story. Anyway, are we good?
I think so, unless you guys have anything to add.
Ew.
Yeah.
Ew?
Ew. And she's cold. Alrighty. Well, you guys have yourselves a great evening, and we'll see you next week with something completely different. Have a good night.